as a church historian, which is my academic discipline, I'm always interested in how what people believe and what they think and what they say impacts the way they live, and how that comes into relationships and actions of all sorts, not only in worship, but in more mundane settings as well. So you might say that the two questions behind this session are these. First of all, how do we live a godly life? Okay, that's the first question. And the second question is, how do other people contribute to our living of the godly life? So Christianity and community, how do we live together? And how I would like us to come at that is in this way. First, I want to make some comments and engage you in a little conversation about community, what is it? And then religion, what has it got to do with community? And vice versa. And then thirdly, to just highlight some issues that are raised by four or five examples of Christian communities throughout the ages. And those are the early church, Benedictine monasticism, the Amish, the Shakers, and base Christian communities. I was saying that this is based roughly on a proposed but never taught course at St. Olaf. It has been taught in a slightly different form earlier this year at an elder hostel here at Holden Village, when it was 5 1.5-hour sessions. So obviously we're not going into as much detail and historical background about who the founder was and when that was and how they got transferred from this place to that place and all of that sort of thing. I really just want to highlight some issues that come from those communities. So first of all, the question, community, what is it? The first thing I would say about it is that community is a human impulse and a human necessity. This is a biological fact. An infant, a human infant, cannot survive without other people. Unlike some other animals who are self-sufficient or at least could survive after a relatively short period of time, a human infant takes a long time. No, I have this 3-year-old, and frankly, I don't think he'd make it by himself. He's quite independent and resourceful. He just brought me this afternoon a glass and a pitcher of lemonade out of the refrigerator because I wasn't hopping to quite quickly enough, but someone else did have to have made the pitcher of lemonade earlier in the day. So it's a biological necessity for survival of infants. It seems to be less so as we get older, a biological necessity, and as we come into the modern and postmodern, whatever you think that means, era, we think of it less and less as an economic necessity. My brother, who lives in St. Paul, he must be about almost 30. He has his own apartment, he has his own car, he has his own stereo system. He has his own computer. He has his own job. He is, by very visible measures, economically a unit. About the only thing he has economically that's not a unit is that he and my husband and I own lake property together. And bless his soul, he does all the work on it. All we have to do is send him a check once a month. But there are other ways that community is a necessity and an impulse. One is cultural formation. It's not a matter of survival only, it's a matter of learning to be human. Someone said to me earlier, he's quite fascinated right now by when you're on a hike, you can pee behind a bush. He really likes this. One day he said to me, Mama, what will happen if I poop in the road? Well, Thomas, I think people will think you're a bear. That's not what human beings do, at least not in North America, right? We teach each other, not only do we keep each other alive, we teach each other what human behavior is, what counts as food, right? Teaching fifth grader Sunday school in Chicago when I was in graduate school, right across the street from the Lutheran Seminary, I had both Southside Chicago kids and children of international students. We were reading about St. John the Baptist, and we got to the part about honey and locusts, and all the Chicago kids went, ooh. And the little boy from Madagascar said, they're quite good. So we teach you, we not only keep each other alive, we teach each other what it means to be human. And then we do have these ongoing psychological needs, even if we think we're free from the economic ones. So that's one thing about human community. But as the example of my brother suggests, there are different degrees of togetherness that vary from the totality of a traditional community, a traditional society, in which to know that you belong to this village in this part of Africa, is probably the place where we're most immediately aware of total communities at this point, is to know almost everything there is to know about you. But I tease my students at St. Olaf that even knowing you go to St. Olaf doesn't tell you everything there is to know, like you think I could sing. You would be wrong. I cannot sing, even though everyone assumes anyone at St. Olaf can sing. There are things about us that you can't find out from knowing our community membership. And most of us have community memberships that span, you know, there's not a whole group. And so that's what I want to ask you about, just for a minute. If you would take a second to think of half a dozen people you belong to, or who belong to you, and that's a deliberately ambiguous term. But a few people, you know, five if that's easier for you to keep track of, but think of about five or six people you belong to, or who belong to you. And if you count them on your fingers, I'll know when you're done. And then think about what they have in common. I will ask you to talk about this, but I want you to be prepared first. What do they have in common? And then, are they a community? Now, you're shaking your head, so you get called on. Why aren't they a community? You didn't mean that they're not a community.
No, I did mean they're not. The only thing they have in common is that they know us.
Yeah.
But they know me. But they don't know each other.
Yeah.
Because I'm in connected with widely disparate groups.
Yeah.
Regularly. So,
and yet, would you think of them as being, in some sense, your community, even if they are not a community?
Well, a community, I think, is a cohesive group.
Cohesive.
And I'm in and out of a lot of groups. I'm an education group, I'm a national trade group, I'm in a church group, I'm in a Boy Scout group. I'm in a lot of groups, in and out of a lot of groups.
Yeah. Yeah, so
but I don't consider them
as a total, as a community.
All of them together. No.
So that has this kind of...
Yeah, there you go.
That's it.
Intersecting community.
Rather than...
Yes.
Yeah.
Right? Is that other people's experience of a definite community that would define you? Or that you...
Well, Sam is a member of the community of St. Martin.
Yeah, say something about that.
And And I guess I would think of them as being the core and like the center circle.
Yeah, so you'd have this.
Right, and then there are some people within that circle that we belong to two congregations. Okay. But there are members of the community of St. Martin in both of those church congregations too, both the Catholic and the Lutheran one. So, you know, but we have one major community that probably encompasses most of the people that we see during the week. And I'm not sure
then
I would consider the people I work with to be part of the community, because I guess my definition of community has maybe a deeper notion of commitment to it in some ways.
Okay, anybody else
want to
say anything about what that exercise suggests to you about the people you belong to and your experience or non-experience of community?
I think even here at Holderwad, in some sense, all of Holderwad is a community. Within that, there are a number of sub-communities, so it's more not intersecting circles, but there would be the big circle and then several smaller circles.
So like M.
Yeah, there you go. And some of them may be overlapping and some of them may not be.
Yeah, and that's very deceptive. Not that it's like a big secret, but it's certainly the case about Holden. And the more I'm here, the more I notice a particular group in here, which I call the swallows. You know, the guests who've been here for a week every summer for 25 years. There's a growing cadre of retired people who come every summer to volunteer for 3 weeks. Right? There's a certain few teaching staff who cycle through. Right? Last fall, I was at the Reforming Church Conference at Central Lutheran in Minneapolis. And as I walked around, I said to myself, oh, it's like having a whole Holden summer simultaneously, only with good clothes. Because all these people that I see come through, who I always assume know each other, because I've gotten to the point where I can't distinguish who's here when, or if they were here with so-and-so. I have the same problem with my students. I just say, were you here when? Don't necessarily know each other. And yet some of those people have a very strong sense of community, although there's no common location. Other things people want to say?
I think the people who go to the same college or university have that sense of community, and they may never be able to see each other.
Yeah. Right. So there's something that isn't necessarily about sharing an experience, but having an experience in common, if I can make that distinction between simultaneously doing it and having it at different times. Is this a gesture of wanting to speak? Okay. Let's move along, because I have a lot I'd like us to talk about. Feel free to keep breaking in as we go. One of the points about this is that there are varying degrees of togetherness. I think partly that's a matter of temperament. Not everybody wants as much intimacy or ongoing togetherness as others do. Some really like this, right? And others long for this. There are things, common things that contribute to community, a common location. We speak of living in the community of Northfield, right? Or my parents live in a condominium arrangement, you know, and there's a sense in which there's sort of community there because they live in the same place. But the relationships with some of those people aren't very deep, simply because they meet at the mailbox now and then. Or I just spent a month at Bryn Mawr College living in a dormitory with 80 other higher education administrators. And, you know, we were thrown together. We developed a sort of community, but part of that had to do with simply being in the same place. Language is a very, very important element in community, and one of the ways I think you can see a community and judge its vitality is whether or not the people have a common language or dialect. And Holden, of course, really does this. We used to do sessions on language here, and this was a great thing. I could say, have you noticed any language here at Holden that defines the community? And people would say, Maverick, Waitry, Garbo, da-da-da. Everyone could just spin them off. Language is something that we haven't come
to. Is there a new one to add? Computers. The computer community.
Yes, that's right. And there's no common location in that one. Yeah.
But they feel right at home.
Yeah, virtual community, we call it. Right. Yeah. There can also be common origin that maybe goes to your comment about alumni. You have this common origin at a school. And common belief. And I think that both of this, in particular, goes to that you have a community that's built around belief. And that's what we talk about with the church community, that although there may be other components like location and language and so forth, that it's a common belief that's at the heart of what holds that community together. Larry Rasmussen has said about community, it's both a place and an experience, and it's true. What's religion's contribution? Well, before I can talk very much about that, I just say something about what religion is. This is an extraordinarily slippery topic. I want to say just a brief thing about what religion is, based on the work of Catherine Aldenaes. She's trained as an American historian of American religion, and she's written a textbook, American Religion and Religions, in which she describes religion on the basis of what she says, four C's. Community, creed, okay, these correspond with what I've just said. Community is a group of people, who have the same creed. What she means by creed, as I annotate her, is how you answer the big questions. So it's not necessarily a creed like the Apostles' Creed. It can be fables, it can be artwork, it can be music, but it's the content of that. How do you answer the big questions like, what is life about? What does it mean to be human?
You mean creed is not limited to theology and denominations?
At this point, no. Her study of religion is really from the outside, okay? So she's not making assertions from the inside of a particular religious group. She stands at the outside and looks at them all. And so in order to get four C's, she uses creed. She could have used a different word like belief or ideology. Okay. And then the next is cultus, which might translate into ritual. The peculiar religious, what you would recognize as religious behaviors that this group does on a regular basis, and they derive from those answers to the questions. There should be some correspondence between what you believe and how you act in those arenas, and then code, which could mean ethics, how you act in the mundane areas of your life. All these four things are in Aldenaes's notion parts of religion, and as you can see, community is a key part of that. These other three, creed, cultus, and code, all bind the community together, make it cohesive. It's really, the relationship between these is circular. So that the creed reinforces the community. The fact that everyone believes similar things brings them together. The fact that they behave in similar ways reinforces other things. So it's very much a circular
on that basis, then yoga would not necessarily be religion, because that's very individual without community.
Yeah, but even so, you learn how to do yoga from somebody. So to go back to what I said about community being a human need, that cultural formation means, I would argue, that you cannot be religious by yourself. Henry James has another view about what religion is. He says religion is what you do in your aloneness. Right? I don't think you can be religious by yourself in this very pragmatic way, that other people help us figure out how to be religious. We have experiences, sometimes in common, and we help each other understand what to make of them, right? And if we have similar beliefs and rituals, it's easier sometimes to help people, right? Actually, I just talked to someone today about a colleague of mine in whose family there has been multiple tragedies. And, you know, in a way, I find it much easier to respond to her than other people I know with similarly tragic lives, because I can use, and this maybe, I just don't mean to trivialize it, but because I can speak to her in terms of Christian concepts and beliefs, I can offer her something. And I know that she understands it and that it means something to her as well. Okay, Aldenaes also said that an important part of religion has to do with boundaries. Both how we set them up and how we transcend them. How we set them up is for example, who belongs and who doesn't belong. But religion, if you think in terms of ritual, it's interesting that rituals come all at all these life cycle moments. Birth, adolescence, marriage, death. We have rituals to help us walk from one part of life into another. Right? We mark that crossing of a boundary. Right? So that tradition of the funeral lunch with the little ham sandwiches, you know? Do they do that where you lift ham sandwiches always for a funeral lunch? Well, part of the reason we do that is to affirm our belief as Christians that death is not the end, but that death is the beginning of life, even as at baptism we said, this isn't about life, this is about dying. You're baptized into the death of Christ and then you rise up. And then when we get to the end and someone dies, we say, this isn't about dying, this is about birth and new life. Well, we affirm that not only upstairs in the sanctuary, but also downstairs eating those little ham sandwiches. Interesting that it's also a traditional Easter food, you know? And we affirm our relationships, our community. Even though so-and-so is dead, I still know you. And because I still know you, that means something about so-and-so who's dead. So religion also has to do about boundaries, both putting them up and crossing them. In terms of a specific religion, namely Christianity, I think there are very specific reasons why community is important in Christianity. One, Jesus says, love your neighbor as yourself. Well, if you're going to love your neighbor as yourself, it's hard to be a Christian alone. And Jesus says, tell others. Well, it's hard to tell others if there aren't any others around. So the commands of Jesus, in a very simplistic way, force us into community. There is also the continuation of the Jewish notion of peoplehood, that God chooses a whole people, a whole nation. And insofar as Christianity has appropriated that notion, although each one is baptized individually, our lovely response in the Lutheran baptismal liturgy is to welcome you into this community. There's also a recognition of an incarnational view, I think, that's an important part of this. When Luther writes in the Freedom of a Christian that we see Christ in one another, that incarnation, although it is unique in Jesus, has some echo in all people. It means that we look to other people to help us become Christians or to continue as Christians. Now, having said all of that, I want to draw back and say, but Christian community is this very odd thing, because it transcends time and place. So there's things about location and shared experience, yes, but Christian community breaks down the boundaries of time and place. And anyone who's ever participated in a halfway competent worship service on All Saints Day feels this in a profound and weepy way, unless you have stronger eyes than me, that sense of connection to people who are long dead, some of whom we knew in the flesh and some of whom we never knew. And maybe you also have the experience that I have many times on Sunday mornings of thinking, now, with the time difference, since we're at late service and my parents go to early service, then they must be in church right now. Or the reason I adore the oldest copies of the Haugen Vespers, because I pick them up and they're falling apart. But in almost every one, there are these little notes that say, Kirk, Barbara, and tells who was singing it, leading that night. And I think, oh, Kirk, oh, Barbara, oh, and I get all weepy then, too. because Christian community transcends time and place. It links us together over these barriers that separate us from one another. Okay, now, having said all of that, briefly, some things from some specific communities. Now, most of these, the two on the ends won't do this, but the three I want to talk about in the middle are very intentional, intense experiences of Christian community. And most of us, maybe even you who live in St. Martin's community, do not experience Christian community in this sort of way, you know, like this. Because we live in the modern world with the overlaps, for us, Christian community tends to be more diffuse, more diluted, fuzzier. Sometimes it's maintained by something technological, right? The people who belong to your congregation at such and such a time, and you call them up on the phone, right? And you say, this is happening in our life, could you pray for us? And because of that, I want to start with a paragraph from Dietrich Bonhoeffer's Life Together. And as you may know, Bonhoeffer wrote this for the Confessing Church as they were drawing together in a seminary in a period of persecution, perhaps not too strong a word. And it's really about living in Christian community, and yet he offers us this caveat. One who wants more than what Christ has established does not, and I'm going to say community where he says brotherhood because I think that's what he means. One who wants more than what Christ establishes does not want Christian community. He is looking for some extraordinary social experience which he has not found elsewhere. He is bringing muddled and impure desires into Christian community. Just at this point, Christian community is threatened most often at the very start by the greatest danger of all, the danger of being poisoned at its root, the danger of confusing Christian community with some wishful thinking, some wishful idea of religious fellowship, of confounding the natural desire of the devout heart for community with the spiritual reality of Christian community. In Christian community, everything depends upon being clear right from the beginning. First, that Christian community is not an ideal, but a divine reality. That Christian community is a spiritual and not a psychic reality. I think partly what Bonhoeffer is after here is that although we seek community, community is a gift we already have. Even as our spirituality is the outgrowth of the gift of faith we have already been given. So the things I said earlier in the week about cultivating spirituality have a parallel in the cultivation of a human manifestation of the spiritual gift of community. Now, many people want to look back to the early church, the New Testament and the Apostolic era, thinking that there surely we will find Christian community. I must tell you, it was no golden age. They had no blueprint. They had no guidebook. They were making it up as they were going along. And sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. And if you read the New Testament and the other documents of that era with that in mind, you find these little points of difficulty and friction. That more now as we have accessible to us literature from the same period that's not in the Bible, but which gives us some insight into the social setting of the time. You know, so it seems like as we read that stuff more and more that there's this tension between, say, Peter and Mary Magdalene about who was going to get to be a leader. And then there's that Matthias guy who the lot fell on and you never hear from again. You know, what was that about? So figuring out how to get leaders is one thing that there's a lot of controversy about. We see that there's development over time. There's a 7th century document called the Didache, in which we can see kinds of leadership shifting from what we call charismatic or maybe spirited leadership to official leadership. That once you had prophets and now you hire someone, it's different than it once was. We're learning to adapt to new situations. We also see local variety as each community comes to try to understand how to live with the universal gospel. The gospel is the same, but Paul says, unless it is difficult for the weaker kindred, go ahead and eat that meat, right? And then when Peter comes, he says, no, don't eat that meat, right? There are these debates about how to live out the gospel. Some people find this disturbing to hear this about the early Christian community. My take is this. It gives us, at least it gives me, great comfort to know that the kinds of problems we have aren't weird. They're not because of our weakness. I think they're rather because of the responsibility God has given us and the liberty that we have in the gospel, that we have to struggle with those things and to figure out, well, what do you eat? Do you eat those grapes that they're boycotting? Do you spend this much money on that kind of special treat? Some of the issues that the early church struggled with included who was other, who didn't belong, how do you come to belong? What's the means by which you come to belong? What's the appropriate way to understand belonging? And we see in the earliest documents of the New Testament the rejection of the analogy of family. Remember when Jesus says, unless you hate your mother and your sisters and your brothers, you can't come to me? The rejection of a notion of community which is biological, in favor of one, those who know my Father's will and do it, in favor of one of obedience and belief. And then that breaks down by the time we get to Ephesians. And there in the 6th chapter, we have what we call the household codes that say, wives do this, husbands do this, masters do this, servants do that, children, blah, blah, blah. That seems to have come back in. There are also discussions about standards of behavior and belief. The search for perfection, something that lurks in all Christian community. The striving for perfection, and which, I mean, who can be against striving for perfection? But the related difficulties of me being better than you, and what are we going to do with you now that you're not as good as me or not trying as hard? The Benedictines, founded about 500, are a kind of monasticism, a very specific kind of Christian community. The word monasticism may strike you as an odd one related to community, since it starts with this preface that at least some of you will remember from the pre-stereo days, right? And what was a mono, what do you call it, a mono recording instead of a stereo recording?
Monero.
Monero.
Well, in any case, what did it mean? Forget how you pronounce it, what did it mean?
One
channel. And what's the oneness of monasticism? It can mean, and in the early desert hermit tradition, it often did mean going off by yourself, one person. But a second way of understanding that monasticism is one desire. That the whole community is united around one desire, which is the desire for a godly life. So it's united by this effort, this singular purpose. We know very little about Benedict, who's the author of the most influential rule for monastic life. He lived from about, we think, maybe 480 to about 550, maybe. in northern Italy and might have been an aristocrat. And, I mean, we don't know a lot about him, but we have this book he wrote, which he calls A Small Book for Beginners, almost exactly the same phrase Luther uses to describe the catechism. He says that this book should challenge the strong without discouraging the weak. Now, is that a great goal? To challenge the strong without discouraging the weak. In this little book, he gives out rules for everything. How you should sleep, what you should eat, when you should worship, how you should use the Psalms to get through all 150 in a week. It's a combination of theory and practice, which is stunning in its applicability centuries later. As I'm learning to be an administrator, I'm thinking of Benedict all the time. The man was brilliant. And I think that's one of the reasons his rule has endured. It allows for flexibility of application in wonderful ways. So he says things like, well, you should have these clothes, but of course in the winter you should have more if it's cold, right? And you should have these foods to eat, except if you're in a place where that's hard to get, then eat something else. And this is how you should teach people, this is what my students always have a horrible time about, because although the principle is good, the specific is not so great. He says some people you can teach this way, some people you can teach that way, and some people are just so stubborn and obstinate you have to beat them. They won't learn any other way. Now, I don't know that I would agree with you have to beat them, but it is the case we've learned that people have different ways of learning. So there's this flexibility of application, even while a single purpose. It's called a rule, and I'd like Joan Chittister Willitsen distilled from the Daily. Joan Chittister has been a prioress in a Benedictine house. I didn't bring the part about rule. She talks about a rule being a guide, not like a rule book. Some comments about it. One, it was very hard to join a Benedictine community. And I think that's significant when we look for communities that are cohesive and that really help us learn godly life. It was hard to join. The daily life was punctuated by worship, so that everything about community was not this worldly. That the tensions of the day were brought again and again and again into a room where you have to stand by somebody and pray with them. Living in a small town like Northfield, even though we do have four Lutheran congregations, means that I do this often with my colleagues. And it is significant to me when I go up there to the Eucharist to receive, and I look across and I think, God, you're really about to meet this weekend. Here you are. And I have to stop and shift when I'm thinking about why I was bugged and the person who was bugging me. The community gathers before God. It's like, don't you know people you just can't be a jerk around? We have a blessed number of them in Holden Village where it's just, you can't gripe in front of them because they're so generous. And there's something about being in worship together that's like that. That's not to demean the importance of work. Both manual and intellectual work are an important part of the Benedictine tradition. That we don't think our striving after God is disconnected from things like logging, baking, washing diapers, reading poetry, writing letters. Silence was an important part of it, and more I come to think maybe it's my Scandinavian heritage, although I am that odd duck, a loud Scandinavian. I come to think that silence is an important part of this community. Not for the silence itself, but for the integrity it allows to those who are there. And then finally, obedience. Obedience to the abbot as to Christ is how we usually think of this. We might also think about it as giving one's own best self to the community. Benedict says, when he's talking about readers, don't let people who are bad readers read for everybody. They feel bad and no one can understand. Obviously, I'm paraphrasing Benedict. Well, how true? How many times have you gone to church on Sunday morning and let someone read who can't read? You're just sitting there feeling awful for them and not hearing the lesson. Not a good idea. Give your best to the community. That's a kind of obedience or a kind of humility. Unfortunately, we've run out of this book in the bookstore. This is my big recommend of the summer. Roberta Bondi's book, Memories of God, Theological Reflections on a Life. In that book, she writes about humility. This paragraph, it's in relation to the desert hermit tradition. Humility for the ancient teachers meant accepting ourselves and others just as we are. Limitations, vulnerabilities, and major imperfections included, as already valuable and beloved of God, without our having to prove our worth by what we accomplish, what we own, what we do right, or by our status in the society and in the church. This meant that humility was about slipping underneath the whole hierarchical social web of judgments by which we limit ourselves and one another in order to love and act fearlessly with power and authority. Humility and obedience, I think, are closely connected. That willingness to see ourselves, one's own self, and others as we are, and then to act for the benefit of everyone, allows us to be fearless, to take the power that God has given us and the gift of community that God has already given us. Not to say, well, I'll be your friend if, you know, or so-and-so used to be my friend and then, but to accept the good and the bad about one another. Now I come to Chittister, something she says about community. Community goes astray when it begins to be simply a jumping off point for our own personal ambitions, instead of an arena in which I am meant to give my gifts to the rest of the human race so that we can all live together better together. When I begin to think that my community owes me this, or my family doesn't love me unless they give me that, or my friends have to change their plans for mine, then I'm clearly intent on creating a world unto myself, not a community. When her career and his ambitions and their laziness become the pivot around which these relationships to begin to operate, we don't have community at all. We have, lovely phrase, a privatization of the Garden of Eden. Okay, jumping across the centuries, we come to the Amish. 16th century Anabaptists. One of their number said, Hans Denk, no one may truly know Christ except he follow Christ in life. This is really at the heart of the Anabaptist tradition, that Mennonites are in the same tradition. Unlike what had happened in medieval Catholicism, where the monastic life was held up as especially holy and available only to the few, the Anabaptists said everyone should live as a monk. All of life should be the search for God. They had believers' baptism, which the church was equal to the community. The boundaries are very clear. And any of you who have visited Lancaster County or the area around Goshen, Indiana, know that the people look, you know, you can tell when you see them on the street. This is just, I'll pass around, a charming children's book about the Amish, which disrupts our notion that they are solemn, dour people. It's about a little girl who wishes for something fancy and buys strange set of, well, actually it falls out of this van. She gets this egg, which she hatches. It's sort of an ugly duckling until one day, where they say it, they realized that Fancy was too fancy to be Irish, and they locked him in the hen house. And then there was a barn raising and a quilting, and they were very worried about this, and then, oh dear, gets out of the hen house and climbs up on top of the quilt and shows. And they were so frightened that Fancy would be shown. And then the wisest old woman said, "It's God's handiwork. Only God could think of colors like that." So, the Amish has very clear boundaries. My students always think they're not very religious. Because all the things that they notice about the Amish, they don't think are religious, like how they look and what they eat and the fact that they don't have cars and telephones. But for them, those all are religious decisions. There's a very intentional limitation on life in order to focus. This lovely, very idiosyncratic book about the Amish called Plain and Simple, A Woman's Journey to the Amish. It's written by a potter who saw quilts like these, you know, and fell in love with them and decided to go and visit the Amish. And it's a strange experience for her because here's a woman who's dedicated to being extraordinary. And she finds herself being attracted to these people who value being ordinary. One of the things she learns about them is that keeping values alive is a constant redefining process. A living faith is one that gets constantly tested. And each of those decisions about the Amish, what you wear, when they decided to let adolescents wear running shoes, to use a gas engine on a tractor, to have freezers, each of those decisions is carefully made. It keeps life on a human scale. It focuses on the benefits and the costs. The same is true about education and private property and corporate work. All of those things are intentional limits on a life which is supported by community. Here's a good example of that. The Amish don't buy insurance. And what if you get sick or your barn burns down? Well, that's what the community is for. And if you can't pay it back in this generation, there's the next, right? So this sense of duration is an important part of it. We call them the plain people or the quiet in the land. It's interesting to me that people who we regard as plain have developed such a beautiful aesthetic and that people seek after their quilts and their toys, and as the Shakers, after their furniture. So, from the Benedictines, we think about obedience, humility, the relationship of self to group. From the Amish, we can think about limits. How do limits give freedom? Think of all the choices you make every day and all the energy you expend on them. Like when they stopped making my shampoo, there I stood in the grocery store aisle, I swear, for half an hour, trying to figure out what kind of shampoo to buy now, because I always just bought the same kind, you know? And it seemed like they didn't make Breck anymore, so I couldn't go back to that. And the Amish make choices carefully, but choices that don't require so many choices. The Shakers, or the United Society of Believers in Christ's Second Coming. It's an American group that began about the time of the American Revolution. A more technical definition would be say that they're a celibate millenarian sect with socialist communities. What does this mean? It means, one, that their understanding of sexuality is that sexuality is at the heart of sinfulness, so that as you progress toward perfection, they don't have sex, right? Millenarian is that they are anticipating a new world. In fact, they hope that they are beginning it. And one of the marks of its beginning is that Mother Ann Lee, their founder, was understood, not in her own lifetime, but later, as the second incarnation of Christ. as Jesus was the first male incarnation and Lee is the female incarnation. And I should say about the Shakers that they have a different kind of relationship to Christianity than these groups that I've been mentioning, right? They're sectarian, means not only that they have strong boundaries of membership, but also that they move beyond what is the conventional doctrinal center of Christianity. They have social communities, they own property in common. I've written up here Stephen Stein's book, The Shaker Experience in America. Unlike Sue Bender's, is very accessible and idiosyncratic and has pictures. Stephen Stein's is very technical and somewhat dense and has pictures. I'm going to send around two pictures from Stephen Stein's book. This is what you would expect to see if you know anything about the Shakers. It's a picture of Shaker worship in a dance. And this is a little bit later. This is two Shaker sisters with saxophones, just about the time the saxophone was gaining prominence. At the height of the Shakers, there was 19 communities. And at present, there are a few Shakers. Stein has as a chapter title late in his book a quotation from a Shaker sister who says, "I almost expect to be remembered as a chair." Three things I want to say about the Shakers. They have peculiar doctrines about the second incarnation of Christ. They also are very concerned about balance. They have dualism, a very dualistic worldview, particularly related to sex, maleness and femaleness, but it's always balanced. So that in the first picture, you see them dancing. You need the same number of men and women to do this dance. Their buildings, maybe some of you have visited some of the Shaker villages, always have two entrances, the sister's entrance and the brother's entrance. Their leadership structure had an elderess and an elder, a deacon and a deaconess. Everything is balanced. Balance is critical for the Shakers. Their famous hymn, "'Tis a gift to be simple, and when we come down right," it's balance, right? We come down right. For them, the spirit is central. Benedict writes a rule. He's not uninterested in the spirit, but he has a lot of rules. They are most concerned about the spirit, so that union and order are balanced by gift. This is one of the critical, difficult things about living in community, how to have order and to allow room for the Spirit's gifts. Their daily life is well described by Mother Anne's phrase, "hands to work and hearts to God." It's not unlike Benedict's view about working and praying. The more contemporary example is the base Christian or ecclesial communities began as a contemporary Roman Catholic phenomenon in Central America. It has parallels, however, and I think instructive parallels with earlier Protestant groups such as 17th and 18th century Pietism and 18th century Methodism. If any of you are Methodists, then you know the phenomenon of the class meeting. There's many parallels between the class meeting as it was originally devised and sometimes continues to be practiced. All of these groups have very permeable boundaries, rather like St. Martin's community in that regard. People go in and out. They're not necessarily residential. They don't necessarily own property in common. The leadership structure may be quite fluid. These emerge in the context of post-Vatican II Roman Catholic theology and the political liberation movements of Central and South America. We might define base ecclesial or Christian communities as small groups of Christians who live near each other, gather to study the Bible, worship, and for other activities, which can range from something like securing a new water system to bringing in a new government, to revitalizing the church. And I think one of the most important things that base Christian communities bring to this discussion of Christianity and community is the goal of community. That I started by saying the goal is a godly life and how other people contribute to our each living the godly life. I think base Christian communities really challenge us to think about the eschatological future how today's community prepares us for what is to come, the foretaste, right? As well as the change, the immediate changes beyond ourselves. What is our responsibility, not only for ourselves and our little community, but for the larger world around us? None of the groups I have described were without influence on the world around them. The early church, the Benedictines, the influence of the Benedictines is great, as teachers, among other things. The Amish have commercial and other kinds of influence, and so did the Shakers. Well, we're nearing the end. I want to point to four issues. One, what's the in community and Christianity? What is the relationship between the individual and the group? It seems to me one that in congregations we don't struggle with very much. We tend to think more about what the individual owes the group and less about what the group owes the individual, or what the group, I don't know quite how to say this, how the group can form the individual, can call an individual into account, can challenge without discouraging one another. Another is the importance of mundane and material things in the Christian life. How do we help one another understand the significance of what we have? Several summers ago, I remember Walt Bowen saying, "When they come to do my stewardship call, I wish they'd ask me how it was with my soul first. Because it seems to me, if you talked about that first, it wouldn't be so hard to fill out the pledge card." We also need always to think about what kinds of external contacts we would like to have and how the external environment shapes us. For most of us today, the Christian community in which we live is our congregation. And the relationship of the congregation to our other communities is likely to be quite minimal. Unless you live in a small town, unless your whole family belongs there, I mean, there are these other things that affect that. How does the external context affect the difference between being a Christian community in the South Bronx and being one in Pierce, South Dakota? That what's on the outside has to be part of this life. And then finally, I think every Christian community, and Holden is no different in this regard, has to think about how to respond to change, both internal and external change. That community is a living thing, and as Sue Bender says about a living faith, that means it's always changing. I'm afraid I've gone almost to the last minute, but if anyone wants the last word or two, I'm happy to hear it. And I always say about Holden sessions, they stop, they don't end. I expect you to talk to each other, people who aren't here, and me if you want, about these things. It's a beginning, not an end. So.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're very attentive at a difficult time of day. Did I say something about all my books? No. These bottom two, Heppelthwaite Basic is Beautiful, is really about how North American and European church people can learn from base Christian communities. And Lee Dardo and Clovis Boff, Introducing Liberation Theology, is a more technical introduction to base Christian communities. You can tell I'm a college instructor. Always giving bibliographies. Yes.
Were the people in Northfield happy that Jesse James was really in his grave?
You know, I haven't been in Northfield since that was confirmed, but of course we are very fond of Jesse James.
I understand you still have the Jesse James days.
No, we have the defeat of Jesse James days. Yes. We reenact the raid every year on multiple, you know, several times a day during that event. Thank you.